to the Strong Sisters YouTube channel. Today we have the pleasure of Morley Robbins returning to our channel to discuss all things magnesium. So he is known originally as the Magnesium Man. So in this video we cover what is magnesium, why pretty much everyone should be supplementing, what are the best types to supplement with, how much should we be supplementing. But while I have you guys here, make sure you hit the like and subscribe button and let's just dive right in.
All right, hey Morley, thanks for coming back on our channel today. Our audience has really enjoyed our last two videos about iron. And so today I know we are diving into the topic of magnesium. And I think a good place to start is just what is magnesium so we can better understand this mineral before we get started talking about it.
Okay. Well, this is the mineral that I cut my teeth on. I, for some reason, was drawn to it. And people always get a kick out of finding out how did it really happen. And so I was learning and doing a lot of reading, and one of Dr. Liz's clients said, you know, you ought to really write about what you're learning, and I think you should use paradoxical intent. And I looked at her and I said, what is that? And she said, it's reverse psychology. She was a psychologist. And I went, oh, I could do that. So the very first book that I wrote was about this big, little tiny paperback, and it was called Let's Get Fat. And it was a 10-step program on how to get fat. And it was guaranteed, you know, and I sold them for like $3. And people would buy them and they'd start reading it, and they'd go, wait a minute, I'm doing most of those. And I said, how's that working for you? And so then I wrote one. Let's break bones. You know, everyone's worried about osteoporosis. I said, well, let's figure out how to really break them and then do the opposite. And then I wrote one called Let's Make a Heart Attack. Don't wait for it. Let's go on offense and let's make it. And so it was a 10-step plan. They were all 10-step plans. And step number 7 in the 10-step plan to make a heart attack was eliminate magnesium from your diet. And what was really funny about the seven of those 10 steps that I used for that Let's Make a Heart Attack came from the American Heart Association. Because I could take the research that I was coming across and correlate it with what they were telling people to do, like stop eating cholesterol. That's the worst thing you could do. And another one of Dr. Liz's clients, who's also a practitioner, I asked her, could I have you read this article that I've written? She said, oh, sure. And so she came back over from the weekend and she said, no, I really enjoyed this. She said, it was very, very entertaining. She said, but I can't help but think that step number 7 isn't more important than you realize. So that was golden tongue wisdom, because it was about eliminating magnesium. So I thought, well, maybe you're right. So I went out and bought Carolyn Dean's book, The Magnesium Miracle. And it was like reading a murder mystery, because now I suddenly knew why everyone was in the hospital. You know, I spent all this time working in hospitals. And I was always curious, why is everybody so sick? And what you very quickly learn is that when you are, quote, magnesium deficient, you got a whole host of symptoms, whether it's neurodegeneration or heart disease or kidney disease or whatever it is, they all have a connection to magnesium deficiency. And so I thought, well, we just need more magnesium. And that's going to reverse all the problems. And that's when I began to realize that this process of healing is a lot more complicated than just, you know, units in and units out. And that was the galvanizing event that got me started to really dig deeper to learn. So why does everyone lose magnesium? What's from stress? And so I became a real zealot around stress and understanding all the different types of stress. It's not just emotional stress. It's not just worrying about the conversation you're going to have with a few faculty members in a few weeks. And it's not just worrying about how you're going to pay for all that dog food you've got to have in the house to feed your pooches. It's you know, it could be that you've got a bad diet, or it could be you're in a bad relationship, or it could be you live next to, I had a client who was literally 30 feet from a cell phone tower. Well, that was EMF stress that was zapping her. And what was it doing? It was causing magnesium loss. And so the way the body is designed is that magnesium, it's absolutely critical to make ATP inside the body. ATP is actually spelled magnesium hyphen ATP. And here's how it actually works. Let's see if I can get an example, an in vivo picture of ATP. So, sorry for the audio visual. So this is, we'll pretend this is ATP, right? And when ATP is holding a magnesium ion, it leaves these three phosphates available for making energy. And so the body will take off one of these, but when it does that, it loses magnesium. Really important. And so one of the things that I learned along the way, is that sophisticated graphics or what? Really, it's like, it doesn't get any better than that. But I was always fascinated by open heart.
So you have the magnesium here. The magnesium isn't there, then the ATP
doesn't work. The body can't recognize it. Technically, for the purists out there, the magnesium is actually over here.
Okay.
And if it's not there, if magnesium isn't there, it's like the ATP is wearing an invisibility cloak, like Harry Potter. Body can't see it. Body can't use it.
You're not making energy.
You can't take advantage of it. So this is ATP is potential energy. Magnesium ATP, that becomes energy.
Cool. Okay.
Very, very, very different concepts. And so I was always fascinated by open heart surgery. You know, it's a pretty, very interesting field of science and medicine. And I was intrigued by the fact that cardiac surgeons are obsessed with knowing the pH of the heart. When they're in surgery, they've got to monitor it. So when we're in optimal physiology, we have a pH, our blood pH is between 7.35 and 7.45. That's called physiological pH, very tiny window. And the rest of the body pretty much revolves around that, except in the digestive tract, which most people don't understand, that we go from this incredibly alkaline to acidic, and alkaline, acidic, alkaline digestive tract. And people think, oh, I just need to make my body alkaline. No, you don't. That's not a good idea. But the heart, if the pH goes down to 6.2, all the magnesium ATPs disappear. All the magnesium gets lost. And then the person has what's called a heart event. And so that's why cardiac surgeons are worrying about the pH of the tissue, because they don't want to have a heart event to deal with on top of the bypass surgery. So it's a very important concept. And so when I began to understand the relationship of magnesium to ATP, that's when I came up with the idea of the magnesium burn rate, that when we're under stress, we're constantly losing that magnesium. It goes right into our urine, and we got to restore it every day.
What about the stress causes us to lose that magnesium?
It's just the way the body is designed. You know, you as the engineer know what you're fascinated by is how do we make things work, right? I mean, that's really what you want to know. Well, the de-engineering is just as important, which is what you're trying to figure out here. And the body is designed to, the transaction that the body goes through is that when we're under stress, we need to come up with energy to deal with it. And the best definition of stress I've ever come across was by a functional physician at the Cleveland Clinic, Mark Hyman. And his definition of stress, which I think is superb, is stress is the body's inability to make energy for the mind to deal with its environment. And so the whole process of stress, when we feel the tightening in our stomach, when we've got a paper due, we've got to pay taxes or whatever it is, that whole dynamic, there's magnesium loss because we've got to come up with energy to deal with that stress. And that's the price we pay. As soon as there's stress, there's magnesium loss. And again, this is not my idea. This goes back to Dr. Fiedler in 1899. This goes back to Hans Selye, the father of stress, who was the one who did 30,000 animal experiments to figure out how do animals respond to stress. And the way you guys or gals and your dogs respond to stress is identical, absolutely identical. There's a lot of different ways that we experience stress, but the response to stress is one mechanism. And the very first response is magnesium loss, which then messes up the electrolytes. And what we've lost the magnesium, right? And then the electrolytes start to get messed up because magnesium regulates the electrolytes. Okay, very important to know that. There is a orchestra conductor leader. And once the electrolytes get messed up, there's an energy loss. And when there's an energy loss, guess what happens to the cell? It's going to die. You know, how long can you all, have you ever fasted? Have you ever tried to see how long you can go without food? What was the longest you all fasted?
We went just over 72 hours.
Yeah, we kind of abused fasting a little bit in the past. Not like excessive 72 hours, but we probably shouldn't have been fasting when we had amenorrhea. But
okay. That's another. Again, okay, so then that fasting became another stressor, right? So the longest I ever did it was 9 days. And the world changes. Everything slows down when you don't have food for over a week. It's a very different experience. And I was, you know, drinking water and some apple juice, but no food. And it was an amazing experience to
You mean apple cider vinegar?
Yeah, not apple juice.
Okay. I was like, that's not fasting, Morley.
Yeah, apple that's cider. Thank you for calling me on that. No, it was a fascinating experience. I didn't expect to see the world slow down as I slowed down. It was really very cool. But again, that is a stressor. And what I did for about 20 years, I would fast every quarter. With the change in seasons, I would always do a 1 or 2 day fast. And I just decided at one point, I want to see how far I could go. It was actually fascinating to do it. But the important thing is that the fasting is just another stressor. But what fasting also does is it upregulates what's called apoptosis, which allows the cells to burn through the garbage they've got and get rid of it. One of the things that can get rid of is iron. It's actually a very, very interesting process. But the important thing is to understand that magnesium is the first mineral to go, and right on the heels of it are the B vitamins, the water-based B vitamins, and they go right into the toilet. And people don't
realize. Wait, when you're fasting or when you're stressed?
Just under stress. Just okay. Under stress. Anytime you're under stress. And what it took me years to understand was there's a difference between acute stress and chronic stress. So acute stress is, you know, just a sudden event. You've got some deadline or something that's really, you know, in your face, and that's going to be the magnesium and B vitamin loss. But when there's chronic stress, you live next to a cell tower or you're in a bad relationship or whatever it happens to be, the liver's reaction to that stress is to make metallothionine, which is a very powerful protein that binds up copper 1,000 times more than it binds up zinc. And so suddenly, the energy producing ability of the body goes south under chronic stress. And what the body's not being demonic. Think about the wisdom of the body. The body's saying, the body's really smart. We know that. The body's monitoring, saying, wow, this organism doesn't seem to be able to cope with its environment. So I'm going to start to take it offline. And it's the exact opposite of what you would expect to think the body would do. But as the stress just stays chronic, the body's like, I can't deal with this. I can't live like this. So I'm going to begin to change the physiology to respond to it.
So you have an imbalance of zinc and copper.
Exactly. And as soon as copper gets bound up, iron starts to build in the liver. And then you've got a crisis on your hands. And guess who gets lost to that buildup of iron in the liver? Go ahead.
That's exactly right.
And so that's the magnesium burn rate. But that took me about almost six years to figure out the circle, because I was just focusing on the magnesium in the beginning. And there was this arduous process to learn about copper, then find out it's bioavailable and unbioavailable, then to find out when it's not bioavailable, it's allowing iron to rise, which is allowing oxidative stress to rise. And it's that oxidative stress that burns up magnesium.
So I think one similarity between Morley Robbins' view and Ray Peet's view is that in the current modern age, in the current modern era, we just experience significantly higher stress levels than our ancestors. Mm-hmm. And so we can't really approach our diet or supplementation as they did, because we live in a completely different environment. And so the physiology is going to change and require other nutrients. So I would say that your argument is that getting magnesium in food isn't enough this day and age. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Because of how much stress we all experience from our jobs, our relationships, our EMFs everywhere, 5G and everything that we're trying to accomplish in multitasking. You're kind of making the argument that food isn't enough.
Yeah. And we live in a switched on society.
Yeah.
Where everyone's connected. And so there's the stress of communication, but there's the stress of blue light.
Yeah.
Right? Behind all the equipment that we play with. And it's really, it is very stressful. And there's a price to be paid for that stress. And people need to understand that. And the real critical issue is for people to realize that, just as you say, you can't just rely on diet in the modern era. It isn't there.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people, the adage is that if it's green, it's got chlorophyll. And so if it's got chlorophyll, it's got magnesium, right? That's what we're led to believe.
Oh.
Well, I remember being in a store talking to a produce guy about the broccoli. And I was just commenting on, I said, really, it looks so green. It looks so ready to eat. And he said, can I tell you a secret? And I said, uh-huh. I almost didn't want to hear this. Do you know how they ripen broccoli? I don't think Ashley wants to know, Sarah.
I don't like broccoli, so give it to me. It'll be another reason why not to eat broccoli.
they spray it with nitric oxide.
Oh, no.
And it forces it to turn green. So it's like, okay, sorry. Actually, glad I know that, but almost sorry that I know that. So again, you've got to know the farmer. You've got to know what the conditions are and things like that. And so you just can't go by the simple rule, well, if it's green, it's got to have chlorophyll.
Yeah.
And it's just,
that's another point. So right now in our modern era, we're experiencing a lot more stress than our ancestors. But also, like we talked about last time, our soil is depleted of nutrients, and so our food has significantly less. And so it's just near impossible to just rely on our food for magnesium. So there's like two things, yeah.
And that's why regenerative farming is so important, which I really admire what you all are trying to do there. But let's put it into a historical context. If we go back all the way to the beginning, that it is said that we evolved from the sea. You know, let's just play with that. So what's the composition of calcium to magnesium in seawater? Well, it turns out there's three parts magnesium to one part calcium. Three times as much magnesium in the seawater as there is calcium. Now, very important magnesium expert is Andrea Rosenoff, and she's based in Hawaii. And she did a study in 2012 to look at the magnesium to calcium ratio in the then modern diet, 2012. So it was, you know, 8 years ago. What would you guess the ratio of calcium to magnesium is in the modern diet?
2014?
In 2012, yeah.
Magnesium to calcium. I'm just going to guess.
Go ahead.
1 to 3, so opposite.
Right. It's actually 1 to 5.
Oh.
So we've gone from 3 parts magnesium.
Wow.
To 1 part calcium. Now, it's 5 parts calcium to 1 part magnesium. That's a 15-fold change.
Oh, wow.
Think about that. And so that affects the way our tissue communicates. And when you go back in time and you look historically, our ancestors' environment was very magnesium-rich and calcium poor. And there are 3 hormones that regulate calcium. Why would the body have 3 hormones to regulate calcium? Because when it got it, it wanted to hold on to it, right? So you've got parathyroid hormone, you've got calcitonin, and you have hormone D. It's not a vitamin. That's the biggest scam on the planet. And so those 3 hormones have this profound responsibility to manage calcium. And guess what they all key off of? All 3 hormones key off of magnesium status. So, and again, I didn't make this up. Robert K. Rood, MD, PhD at USC Medical Center, brilliant endocrinologist, is the guy that figured out how magnesium dependent those calcitropic hormones are.
So what happens when you are not regulating calcium? Bones.
You're creating calcification all over your body. Calcium is supposed to be in the bones. But, you know, more than 99% of it is in the bones and in your teeth. That's where it's supposed to be.
So before we started recording, we were talking about somebody you were talking with who was dealing with calcification. What symptoms was she having?
Her kidneys. She said, I had so much discomfort in my kidneys. And now what she's got is a thyroid nodule. And so it just, again, I think she said that her storage hormone D, that's the one that the doctors always measure, the storage level, got up to 120. And the leading clinicians, the intelligent clinicians who understand what hormone D is, they say that there's no need to have storage D above 21.
Oh, wow.
So a 120 is, it's like off the chart.
And she was heavily supplementing with vitamin D?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, for 3.5 years.
Oh, wow.
And that was at the request and recommendation of her doctor and her naturopath. The we don't need to get into it now, but the vitamin D issue is, I personally believe it's one of the greatest causes of misery on this planet that people don't understand. I mean, it's really tragic what's happened to people's understanding about why we need vitamin D and why we really need retinol, which is
I know you wrote about the vitamin D in your upcoming book. And so We'll obviously share that, but we'll have to have a future conversation.
Is this book called How to Calcify Yourself?
How to Calcify.
No, I changed my strategy. I decided to build on the root cause. And what I learned, which I didn't know until recently, is that the number one reason why people go see their doctor is fatigue. They're tired.
Yeah.
Which makes sense. And so the book is going to be entitled The Root Cause of Fatigue. And that's going to get people into how do we make energy? Most people have no idea. I eat food and it becomes energy. And that's fine, but I think people need to know that there's many moving parts. And actually, when you get into the energy production inside the mitochondria, if you don't have magnesium in the Krebs cycle, you got a problem. If you don't have magnesium in it's called anaerobic glycolysis, 8 of the 10 enzymes are magnesium dependent.
Oh, wow.
And that's a good thing to know, right?
Yeah.
You think, wouldn't they teach that to doctors? You'd think that'd be pretty important to know that, right? Not a word about that. And so the tragedy is number one reason why we go see doctors, fatigue, and doctors don't know how to measure energy and they don't know how to make energy. And that, I call me crazy, but I think that's a problem.
So magnesium is obviously very important in energy production. But one question from our audience, and I think it's interesting. So you always talk about how minerals have a counter mineral, right? So magnesium and calcium, iron and copper, sodium and potassium.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
So based on our discussion a few minutes ago, where you were saying we're now in a calcium heavy society, mm-hmm. if we're rapidly increasing our magnesium supplementation, do we need to worry about increasing our calcium as well? Do both of those need to rise?
I think that's a fair question. As a rule, what I recommend people do is mineralize their water. Any water that they drink or cook with should be mineralized. So that means you add minerals to the water.
Something like trace minerals?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then I have an obvious bias for magnesium, just because of the constant burn rate. But then I recommend people eat an ancestral diet. That's my way of weaving through all of the different diets du jour. Is it carnivore, vegan, paleo, keto? It's like, let's go back to our ancestors and see what they ate. And that's the beauty of Weston A. Price, because he identified what the diet was 100 years ago, before all of this insanity started. And I think it's an important baseline for people to be aware of. And his, it's interesting, his going in proposition was that everyone would be vegetarian and everyone would be low fat. Because he was driven to find, what's that?
Was his initial hypothesis?
That was his initial hypothesis, yeah. Because he was very gifted dentist in Cleveland, and he had done a root canal for his 10-year-old son who died because of the root canal. And that's why he and his wife spent a decade traveling the globe looking for perfect teeth to see what were these people eating that had perfect teeth. And he was meticulous about his research, documented it very well. And to his greatest attribution is that he was very forthcoming with the fact that he was wrong about his hypothesis, and that there were 14 communities that they had identified. Every community had animal protein from ants in Maasai tribesmen in Africa to the Inuit Indians eating whale blubber, but they all had animal protein. And their average was about 60 to 65% fat in their diet. It was not a low-fat diet at all. And he realized that that was what really enabled the proper circulation of the minerals in the body. And I think one of Sally Fallon's real contributions is to explain how important retinol is to getting the minerals into what's called the bone bank so that we can draw on them. And the bones are very important for storing minerals, but again, that's not taught in conventional doctor school. And so the key is really understanding that historical context. And they were very mineral rich. The diet was very mineral rich. And again, if you don't know about Weston A. Price, if you don't know about the pioneering research that he and his wife did, then you will get lost in the diets du jour because you don't know what the foundation is.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to start when you're looking into like dieting instead of just jumping on another bandwagon of like what a quick fix is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
If we could circle back to magnesium gangrate really quickly.
Sure, absolutely.
Is ancestrally consistent as women did get pregnant. And so one of the questions from the audience is, how does pregnancy affect the burn rate?
How much time have we got? there's a famous physiologist, name was Joseph Barcroft. If we want to be stuffy about it, his name was Sir Joseph Barcroft. And he studied mountain climbers. That's what he really, he started his career studying people who were at elevation. And then he got fascinated by obstetrics.
What's this? I don't know what that is.
Obstetrics is the field of medicine that studies babies.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, pregnancy and obstetrics. You know, OBGYN.
Okay.
Obstetrician and gynecologist. So obstetrics is the field of study. And he's famous for coining the phrase, pregnancy is Mount Everest in utero. Mount
Everest. I
haven't
been pregnant, so what does he mean?
Okay, we're gonna get to that. And so then a famous magnesium researcher, Mildred Seelig, who was a mom and an MD, and it had an MPH, and she started out her career as a drug researcher with Big Pharma until she realized that all the drugs that they were making caused magnesium loss. So then she devoted the rest of her career of many, it was like 50 years, to helping to restore magnesium status in people. And her famous saying is, pregnancy is a magnesium deficient state. So we've got Mount Everest in utero, magnesium deficient state. So what do they have to do with each other? Well, it's taken me years to piece these comments together, but now they make perfect sense to me. Because it turns out that the mom is an aerobic being, breathes oxygen, makes energy aerobically, right? Can't make energy without oxygen. But the fetus that's growing inside her womb is anaerobic.
Ah.
And it's like it's living on Mount Everest. Seriously. So then suddenly, the whole field of obstetrics doesn't make any sense. The baby is making energy anaerobically. And if you go back to what I said just a few minutes ago, how many of the 10 anaerobic enzymes, eight are magnesium dependent? And so that's why pregnancy is a magnesium deficient state. Just the process of producing a new life inside a woman's body that's the ultimate stress test. The way I characterize it with my clients is the bookends of stress on planet Earth are guys in foxholes worrying about death and moms in birthing suites worrying about life. Those are the two most stressful events on planet Earth. And here's the Here's the catch. If you have any friends who might be pregnant, or if you know friends or relatives who are pregnant, ask them how often the doctor measures their magnesium status. Zero, never. What does the doctor obsess about? Vitamin D.
Oh, I was going to say DHEA.
No.
Oh,
I was going to say those like birth pills.
No.
Prenatals.
Prenatals. But they're worrying about vitamin D and they're worried about iron.
We talked about that last time. Yep.
And it makes no sense for the baby. Here's the thing that I just learned the other day, that regardless of the mom's health status, regardless of what their hemoglobin status is, the baby is born with normal hemoglobin. Now that's the wisdom of Mother Nature, that the baby somehow figures out what it needs in order to have an optimal start in life. And that apparently is not understood in the modern era. And I think we may have touched on the confusion that started at the First World War about women and hemodilution and all that.
Check out our part two video with Morley.
Yeah.
Part one on iron overload, both. Yeah.
Okay. They're brilliant, right? but the thing is, there's so much confusion about obstetrics and so much confusion about why do I feel the way I do. And there's just an inordinate amount of magnesium burn rate. Again, just the process of building a baby is stressful. So we know there's going to be magnesium loss. But then we find out, wow, the baby's organs can't make energy aerobically. And it's just complete disconnect from the perception that people have. Then we find out that people who want to have a natural childbirth, whether it's at home or a birthing center, well, they're told that they have to have their hemoglobin at 12 or above. That's not natural. That puts tremendous stress on the mom and the baby. And this idea that, well, that's to prevent the mom from bleeding out. The research is not there to back that up. I've been digging at this for several months now, and I'm like, I'm really getting agitated at the disconnect from reality that people are being misled by. And so there's just a lot of confusion in the field. And again, what do young couples want to do? Well, they want to produce perfect babies, you know? I remember that sensation, you know, 30 some years ago when, you know, I've got four kids and they all had to be, you know, just perfect. And it's like, actually the baby's going to do just fine. But the parents worry about it, especially if the mom wasn't pristine in her diet earlier before she got pregnant, then they worry about that, right? And then the real kicker is the fact that there's a very important set of downloads that take place in the last trimester before birth and then about 18 months after birth. Most people don't know about this. So that the big download of iron takes place in the last trimester.
What do you mean by download?
Yeah.
Well, from mom to baby.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
It's literally a download. Yep. But the most important download, in my humble opinion, is the download of copper from mom to baby. So the three of us are adults and we have adult livers that have about 7 milligrams of copper. And that's about what they're supposed to have. And the two highest concentrations of copper in the body are in the liver and the brain, and they're both about 7 milligrams. That's a good thing. When we were born, assuming our moms were healthy and everything was okay, when we were born, our livers had 70 milligrams of copper. So tenfold difference. And then, under ideal circumstances, we're supposed to be breastfed, and we're supposed to get the download of retinol that our body needs in order to make bioavailable copper and turn that copper that's in our liver into ceruloplasmin during the first 2 years of our life. Because in the first 2 years that the baby's developing, it has no immune system. It's dependent on mom and whatever mom is feeding it. Now, here's something that a lot of people don't know. There are cells, the Pac-Men of the body, called macrophages. What would you guess is the percentage of macrophages in breast milk?
High,
yes.
That's one of the reasons why we like to consume raw milk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's 95% macrophages.
Wow. Wow.
What percentage of macrophages do you think is found in infant formula?
Very low.
We were like, looking the other day.
Like nothing?
Oh, wow.
Do you think that might affect the baby?
It's probably a huge problem.
Right. And then the infant formulas are all made with fluoridated water. Another problem.
They're horrible.
Then Mother Nature, when you study breast milk, there is this much vitamin D and there's this much iron.
Oh, they're fortified with iron too.
Well, they're fortified with vitamin D too.
Oh, no.
And so, well, Big Pharma knows better than Mother Nature. What does Mother Nature know? we're going to goose up this baby.
This is so sad.
And then expose, you know, with the soy formulas.
Yeah.
Let's expose the little boy to 25,000 times more estrogen than they're supposed to get. And so we create soy boys. Yeah. Exactly.
We were looking at like a goat milk formula the other day.
It's wonderful. Right.
Oh, no. A goat milk one is probably good, but this was like just a standard one on the shelf, and it was called goat milk. And the first ingredient was like soy.
Yeah.
And goat milk was like the last, and it was like a powder. It was.
Horrible. My wife, she birthed five children at home. This is before I knew her. As a chiropractor, she regularly, when her clients weren't able to produce breast milk, she put them on a goat milk formula, which is the first ingredient is goat milk.
Yeah, that's good.
But you can Google that on the internet, and there's several different formulas.
Goat milk, raw goat milk is the most similar milk to human milk. Cow's milk is a little bit more different. And so if someone has like a digestion issue with raw cow milk, try raw goat milk.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so when I was born, to a pretty sickly mom, apparently, and didn't get breastfed. And I was allergic to everything but goat's milk and eggs.
Mm.
And so when I was old enough, that's what I ate for over a year, was goat's milk and eggs.
That's some nutrients right there.
Yeah. No, it was. And this was down in South Carolina. Apparently the pediatrician down there, very savvy physician. Knew what he was doing, and now I don't have any food allergies.
Yeah.
So I was just very, very grateful for that start.
Cool. If we can, so pregnancy, clearly women should be supplementing with magnesium during this time.
How much though?
Well, that's what I was gonna, so is there any sort of like calculation to figure out how much you should be supplementing, I should be supplementing, she should be supplementing? Because like, we can't all just throw around a number. Is there any sort of ideal calculation?
Yeah, I based my calculation on Mildred Seelig.
On what?
Mildred Seelig, the researcher. Okay. And she had a formula that I just turned into. Hers was based on milligrams per kilogram. I just turned it into milligrams per pound.
Okay.
So the formula that I use is 5 milligrams per pound body weight or 10 milligrams per kilo.
Okay. So that is total magnesium that you should be supplementing with.
Yeah.
Are there things that make it more? So if you're exercising, you're pregnant, obviously.
Right.
That's going to increase your burn rate.
Exactly. If you're an accountant and you're worrying about tax season, you know, or if you have a history of not having a good experience with the holidays, you know, if you know that there's a storm coming, begin to anticipate the storm.
So the five milligrams per gram body weight. What if
five milligrams per pound?
Per pound body weight. Whoops. 5 milligrams of magnesium supplementation for 1 pound body weight. Let's say that person is an athlete. Will that increase?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good.
And again, it depends on what kind of athlete. You know, someone who's doing resistance training.
Yeah.
That's a level of intensity versus someone who's trained to do a marathon.
Yeah.
Versus someone who wants to win the marathon. There's very, very different levels of intensity. But if someone is just routinely exercising, you know, I think you can just up it. The real test to see, am I getting enough magnesium, is you want your bowel movements to be soft but formed.
Okay.
If they become too loose, you've got too much magnesium in your system. And you back up. What's that?
A poop test.
A poop test, absolutely.
There you go.
No, it's a very simple way to measure it and monitor.
You keep increasing until you potentially reach that, and then you can dial back a little bit to find your ideal magnesium. Okay.
Exactly.
So
most people respond very well to the 5 milligrams per pound body.
Okay.
I know you can have too much magnesium citrate and then have diarrhea. So can you dive into the different forms of magnesium, which one you recommend, and then if any are just kind of like
a waste of time and money.
Somebody specifically asked about magnesium threonate.
Yeah, is that like worth the hype? So what are the different types?
There are about 25 different forms of magnesium.
Oh, okay.
but the thing, they're broad categories. So magnesium in the water is the most basic. Again, goes back to the beginning of time. And so that's going to be a form is it's magnesium bicarbonate.
And that's the most, the highest absorbed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's consistent ancestrally. We used to get it in our drinking water because water would like go on rocks and out streams. Okay.
Yep. So that's the most basic. Then we've got magnesium in the food. Again, a safe rule of thumb is if it is like leafy greens, mustard greens, collard greens, beet greens, things like that, they're going to have magnesium because of the color.
I have noticed a consistent trend that a lot of people have digestive issues with those type of greens. And so people have to really thoroughly cook them. Does that cook out the magnesium?
No, I don't think it does. I think ideally you should cook them in lard would be a good thing.
Yeah.
And again, it just enhances the mineral transport.
Yeah.
But green foods is a good source of magnesium. Then we've got transdermal magnesium.
Spray.
Spray or Epsom salt.
Okay.
Or creams. Okay. And so, again, think about our ancient ancestors swimming in oceans. Of course they were being bathed in magnesium.
Because 3 to 1 in the ocean.
Exactly. And so our ancestors used to go to resorts or to healing spas at the ocean to get better. Why? Because there was a lot of minerals that were coming in the ocean air, and the surf is going to be releasing those minerals into the air, which is why people got better going to those spas.
Well, I think a lot of people just think that we have to get our minerals through our mouth, but they forget that like our skin actually has open pores and absorbs these things, and magnesium is actually very bioavailable through transdermal.
And what part of the skin is the most porous on the body?
What part of the skin?
Mm-hmm. Where on your body? Where on your body is the most porous part?
She pointed to her armpits.
Well, that's the lymphatic areas is high. Bottom of your foot, the soles of your feet.
Tyler, one of our followers is going to like that because that's where he suggested. If you have magnesium spray at the bottom of your foot.
Right. And for the moms in the audience, a great thing that they can do with their children, spray the children's feet and massage it before they go to bed. And it's so...
You want to do that? Can you give me a foot massage?
It's great for the mom and for the baby. They just absolutely love it. So, the skin is very important. again, it's this incredibly important organ of our body, which we tend to ignore. And then we have the chelated forms of magnesium. And that's what everyone has been conditioned and trained like circus bears to think, oh, I've got to take it through my mouth. And what is chelation? Well, chelate is Greek for claw. So the claw is holding the magnesium. So the two most absorbable forms of magnesium are magnesium glycinate and magnesium malate. And they have about an 80% absorption rate. And for people who want to really get into this, they can go to a website called Albion, A-L-B-I-O-N, Albion Minerals. I think they're based in like Minnesota. And they have a lot of information about different minerals, but especially about magnesium. And they've got several studies that they've done. But they are the premier mineral supplier on the planet, Albion Minerals. And so those are my two most favorite, just because they're easy peasy. You don't have to worry about it.
So in your PCOS protocol, you do recommend the sprays, the glycinate, and the malate.
Bicarbonate. Yeah. Right. We try to get people to get as many different forms, again, just to cover your bases. People who have gut issues, I know none of your followers have any gut issues.
No one has gut issues these days.
No, and in fact, that's what really prompted the conversation with your follower in Canada, is that she didn't have a good reaction to a chelated magnesium. Mm. I said, you got to stay with the transdermal until you tell me settles down.
Do you think it could cause constipation or diarrhea if you're not dealing with it well? Or what would be that you're not handling it well?
Well, yeah, you potentially could get diarrhea. And again, why do people get constipation? Because they have too much iron and not enough magnesium in their gut. It's not complicated. And they don't have enough methyl groups in their diet. Mm-hmm. You know? So beets are very good at helping to restore methyl groups. Coffee has methyl groups in it. Not a lot of people know that. So people are always curious about other forms of magnesium, like the 3-8.
Yeah.
And 3-8 is it's a good form. It's again, the threonine protein is the claw holding the magnesium. And my comment on that form is twofold. One, they have a better PR department than they have a science department. So they're telling you that it's the only magnesium that can cross the blood-brain barrier. That's not true. It's good, but it's not true. And my real criticism of the product is the reason why Big Pharma despises minerals is they can't patent them. No, that's a fact. And so they are naturally occurring, and so you can't patent a mineral. But what the folks that created magnesium threonate did was they patented a unique formulation. So it was the first way that Big Pharma could get their foot in the door of patenting minerals. And it's a scary development. It's a very frightening. People should be freaking out about it, but they gravitate to it because they've heard it helps them with their anxiety or their brain fog or whatever. Magnesium in general is very good at doing that. Then you mentioned about magnesium citrate. And this is a real point of contention that I have with a lot of people who think it's the best magnesium on the planet. It doesn't take very long to do research to find out that the citrate molecule, the synthetic citrate molecule that gets added to through our diet, is very hard on ceruloplasmin.
Oh, no.
And Dr. Osaki at University of Florida in Gainesville, at FSU, Florida State University, back in the 60s, identified citrate as a natural ceruloplasmin inhibitor. Well, I'm really protective of ceruloplasmin, as you know. I'm like kind of goofy about it. And so I don't want citrate in my body if I can avoid it. And so one of the one of the recommended procedures to do as you get older is to get a endoscopy. You know, we gotta take a scope and see what's going on in your colon, right? Colonoscopy, right?
Yeah.
What's the liquid that they have you drink before the colonoscopy?
Citrate.
Magnesium citrate. And what does it do? It wipes out the colon, right? Clears it out.
I've taken citrate before.
Okay. Does it make sense? Does it seem like a good idea?
No.
Let's wipe out I think people have got to step back from the party line and ask better questions.
Yeah.
And better understand the central role that these minerals play to run the enzymes. And the thing about magnesium is it's 3,752 enzymes that enable our body to work out of the 9,000. So it's 42% of our enzymes rely on magnesium. Now, what you'll hear regularly or what you'll read regularly is, oh, magnesium is responsible for about 300 enzymes. And you'll see that in even some of the most prestigious scientific journals will comment on 300 enzymes. And I decided to wonder where that 300 came from. Well, it turns out there was a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School named Bert Vallee, V-A-L-L-E-E, very high-profile physician. And he was once asked in an interview in the 1950s, Dr. Vallee, how many enzymes is magnesium responsible for? Because he really loved magnesium. And he said, I don't know, it's about 300.
Oh, no.
And that became the bedrock of the scientific citations for magnesium is responsible for 300 enzymes. Uh-huh. Until 2012, when they discovered what's called the magnosome, and that means there's a section in the genetic genome that's really dominated by magnesium. 3,752. 42%. And there's roughly 9,000 enzymes that run our body. And as we probably have said, but I'm just going to reinforce it, they all work just like the cars we drive. When was the last time you drove a car without a key? You can't. Unless you're Wilma Flintstone, it's really hard to do that. And so these minerals are the keys to the engine, and the doctors, who I affectionately refer to as mineral denialists, think of them as hood ornaments on the car. They're not. They're the keys that make the engine work.
Okay, wow. So to summarize the magnesium types, so we've got the magnesium bicarbonate. And so that's the magnesium that was naturally in our water that no longer exists in tap water. And so it's important for people to supplement magnesium bicarbonate. Then we have the transdermal. So that's like the Epsom salt baths and the spray, especially on the bottom of the foot. And then
the creams.
Yeah. And then we have the third types, the chelators.
Chelation.
And then that's like a bunch of different kinds, such as glycinate, malate, threonate, and others.
So then another form that a lot of people might be aware of, there's a product that a lot of doctors use called MAGOX. Mm-hmm. M-A-G-O-X, MAGOX.
And that stands
magnesium oxide. And what the listeners need to understand is that everything's about the absorption rate. So you've got glycinate and malate at around 80% absorbed. How much of the magnesium oxide gets absorbed in our gut?
Do we want to know?
30.
It's 4%.
Oh, wow.
Oh my God.
So,
what?
So on the bottle, it'll say MAGOX 400, and people think they're getting 400 milligrams of magnesium, when in fact what they're getting is 16 milligrams.
Because 4% of 400,
yeah.
Waste of money. Oh, so of
and that's the go-to form of magnesium in allopathic land. No, you have no idea how out of touch with reality they
are. That would be so expensive to supplement with. Because
if you wouldn't know that you weren't getting enough, if you would just chronically be deficient.
Yeah, yeah. But exactly. If you actually chose that one and you needed to get up, that would be ridiculous. But
here's why it's so important. The magnesium and cortisol. Do you all know about cortisol? Everyone thinks it's the stress hormone, right?
Oh, yeah, we talked about that last week.
Well, magnesium and cortisol run on a seesaw. So when magnesium is low, cortisol is high. It means the person is stressed out. Mm-hmm. So how do we chill? Take more magnesium. And then the cortisol just comes back down.
So then wouldn't that mean that someone who fasts would need more magnesium as well
while they're fasting
because of the cortisol rise?
Well, yeah. I mean, again, I think the fasting can be abused.
Yeah.
You have to be very careful not to overdo it. And so a lot of people are doing what's called intermittent fasting.
Yeah.
So Dr. Liz and I are down to 2 meals a day.
Yeah.
So we have a late breakfast and a like around 9:30 or 10 in the morning. And then we'll have our evening meal somewhere around 5 to 6. And that's the food intake for the day.
Yeah.
And that seems to work fine. The energy expenditure when you're 67 is different than when you're 27.
Yeah.
It's just very different.
Yeah.
But it's important for people to realize that, yeah, if you are doing fasting,
yeah,
that is stressful.
Yeah.
And that they need to make sure that the food that they're eating is nutrient dense when they are eating, and that it's really well mineralized. It's very, very important.
So then doesn't coffee increase cortisol as well? So if someone is a heavy coffee drinker, they'll have to increase their magnesium as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting. Do you know if this like any amount there or just rough estimate?
Add trace mineral drops to your coffee too.
I would add like 4 or 5 drops.
Okay.
Would be a good addition. And again, it's very easy to abuse coffee too, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I really try to restrict it to 1 cup.
Yeah.
In the morning, just get my engines fired up. And it works great. But I mean, I know people who drink 10 cups a day.
Yeah.
Just that's too much.
Yeah.
Way too much.
So to circle back to the magnesium again. So mm-hmm. you have the recommendation of 5 milligrams per 1 pound of body weight. Mm-hmm. And then let's say that equals out to like, I don't know, 1,000 milligrams of magnesium that you need to supplement each day. You suggest getting a variety of forms. Do you suggest just like splitting that evenly?
Great question. We can make this really complicated. And I know the gearhead in you would love that actually. Yep. Cause it's just
calculations.
Yeah, no, I know. So what I typically do is have people take a supplement, 5 milligrams per pound body weight. And I said, and if you can add that to that with your water and your diet, we're great.
Good. Okay.
That keeps it simple. And then monitor the bowel movement. And if it's getting too loose, then scale back on the amount of supplement you're taking.
Yeah. Cause that cup. So like, let's say you take glycinate and you do the 5 milligrams per 1 pound body weight. It has an 80% absorption rate. So you are a little bit lower. And then if you have your bicarbonate and you take your mineral baths and you spray your feet, you'll get up there.
Your professors must love you.
She's great.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a significant part of society that wants to know that level of detail. It's very important to honor that. I really try to keep it simple.
Yeah.
Because it's just again, we're all under stress.
Yeah.
We want to keep it simple. You know, just what do I need to do? What's the base that I've got to do? And that's really what the purpose of the root cause protocol is. Here's a good foundation to work on.
Yeah.
What was fascinating talking with this woman from Canada was she says, I'm only on stage 2 of your protocol after 6 months. She says, but man, I feel so much better. I said, great, then just keep doing it. And so, and I've heard that literally thousands of times, which is, that has nothing to do with me. It's Mother Nature. That's the genius of our maker. And I think people just need to know that there are simple solutions out there that don't require a lot of, you don't have to have scientific degrees in order to do that. Trying to keep it simple.
I'm like the mother in this relationship here. Mm-hmm. And so I'm the one who's actually read the root cause protocol and I like give her her pills. And so what I like most about the protocol is that you keep it really simple and you provide somebody with an outline of their day, whether they're mm-hmm. in stage one or stage two or stage three. And so you tell them yeah. how to split it up and eliminates the question of like, oh, do I need to take it all at once? Does it matter? Yep. So I think that's, well, she has yet to read that. And so for anybody who's listening and wants that schedule,
yeah,
it's very helpful to have that.
Yeah.
Well, I think Ashley is very lucky to have you as her sister.
I would not be alive right now.
Right. And and in her defense, she's a tad bit distracted.
Yeah, she is. Oh, I didn't mean that in a bad way. I was just saying.
No, but I think it's important for people to realize. No, I think it's great for people to know that manual or that user's guide, whatever. We've really tried to make it as simple as possible. And Sarah, if you have suggestions to improve it, bring it on, because we're always trying to simplify it so that people can pick it up and just run with it.
Okay.
And for the most part, people are able to do that. So I'm very, very grateful that it made sense to you, and it's something that people can use from day one.
Okay, and then I have one more question. I think I know the answer to this, but
one question?
I have a lot.
You don't just have one. I know you.
You're right.
That's cute.
So let's say you want someone to take 1,000 milligrams of magnesium. I'm guessing that it's better absorbed if you take it throughout the day. So if you just split it up somehow.
Okay.
Okay.
So again, I'm a simple guy. I use my thumb to measure an inch because it's exactly an inch.
I do that too, right here.
Right. And many years ago, I got introduced to a product made by Jigsaw Health. It's magnesium malate, and it's called Mag SRT.
Mm-hmm. Is that what we
use? SRT is sustained release technology. And the beauty of that product, it was the founder of that was Pat Sullivan, very, very gifted entrepreneur, and his son Patrick Sullivan. They're the two that really created that company and brought it to its prominence today. And what Pat Sullivan was struggling with was his energy level. He was really struggling with chronic fatigue. And so he came upon the research of Albion and found out how important malate was, and that they had this ability to make it sustained release, that they could slow its absorption into the digestive tract. And when Dr. Liz and I first started doing nutritional work, we jumped on Mag Citrate, you know? So it was the most popular. It's like, it's got like 60% of the market. And so we had like 10 clients that wanted to do the nutritional approach to healing, and we put them all on Mag Citrate, and 8 of them developed diarrhea.
Oh no.
And it was like, whoa. And so I started surveying manufacturers and suppliers to find a form of magnesium that didn't cause diarrhea. Mm. And fate would have it, and this goes back 8 or 9 years ago, I called up Jigsaw, and who answered the phone? Patrick Sullivan. He just happened to be near the phone and picked it up, and we started talking. And what should have been like a 5-minute conversation turned into an hour-long conversation. And it evolved into what became known as the Pepsi Challenge. He said, you want to field test this magnesium alley? He said, I'll go up against any other magnesium. And so we did that. And it won hands down. And so I've used it ever since. It's the easiest. It's a no-brainer. Again, simple guy. What does that really mean? It means I'm lazy. That's what it really means.
Yeah.
And so I take my magnesium in the morning and I don't worry about it all day long.
Good call. Because we forget it often. Okay.
And see, if you start to divide up your dosing, like I'm really good about taking it in the morning with my breakfast.
Yeah.
But then ask me to do it in the afternoon, I forget and things get in the way. And so I think we can all relate to that.
Yeah. We need to get, so we're good about the pills. We need to get better at the spray and taking the baths, but I've been also making the bicarbonate water. So I think that there are some good products to buy out there, but they're actually pretty pricey, and there's a really inexpensive way of making magnesium bicarbonate. Maybe we'll film a quick video of how we make it. So let's say, like, can you overdo the bicarbonate? Because Okay, you're gonna, the first day that I made magnesium bicarbonate, we used a 1 liter sparkling water. Sarah and I split that, and we went to the bathroom, like, that's so much magnesium bicarbonate.
That's a lot of magnesium.
Much doesn't do this.
So, like, that was a huge lesson that, like, do not drink the whole bottle. I think people get a little bit confused, and they just drink straight from the bicarbonate water, but you're supposed to mix it with your other water that you drink. Do you have, like, a specific ratio that you follow for mixing your bicarbonate with other water?
I should know this cold, right? But I think it's like 1 to 8.
Okay.
I think it's on the website. It should be out there.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was a very heavy dose of magnesium bicarbonate.
Yeah.
But at least now you know your body works, right?
Yeah.
And so the other thing that people don't know about is they know about full baths. And so the formula for a full bath is 1 cup of Epsom salt.
That's a lot more than I've used. Okay, that's good to know.
So a cup of Epsom salt.
Okay.
A cup of baking soda.
Okay.
And a tablespoon of borax. Huh? Oh, I'm being corrected by my brother.
Hi, Liz.
Well, come on.
It's Dr. Liz.
You can correct me publicly. It's okay. This is Dr. Liz.
Hi.
Hi, Dr. Liz.
This is Ashley and Sarah.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Yeah.
I recommend 2 cups of Epsom salt.
Oh, wow.
Half a cup of baking soda.
Okay.
And about 1/4 cup of borax.
Okay, what do those other two components add?
Then you can cut that in half if you want to just do a foot bath.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Foot baths are really fun. What the baking soda does is it just helps the delivery of the magnesium.
Okay.
Because you're making it more alkaline with the baking soda. And then the borax is 98.8% boron. And it's boron is just this mysterious mineral that has a fascinating relationship with iron. So you got boron and iron, and boron is really good at helping to detox the body.
Okay.
And so it's just another way to kind of mineralize the body. And the foot baths are incredibly easy to do. And it's a lot of work to do a full bath, but you can be watching a TV show and have your feet immersed in a foot tub and keep them in there for 30 minutes and you're gonna get the benefit.
The ultimate thing somebody lazy would say, it's a lot of work to do a bath.
No, it is. No, it's you gotta make the water hot, you gotta fill the tub, you gotta And again, think about where society is. What do people do every day? They take a shower.
Yeah.
Our ancestors took baths.
Oh, that's a good point. I mean,
yeah, where the heck would they, how often would they be able to find a waterfall?
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, and our ancestors did not take a bath every day. I can guarantee you that.
Yeah.
Maybe once a week, once a month. Why did women get, back in the day, why did women get married in the summer? Because there were more oils available and more flowers to offset body odor.
Oh.
And we're talking like medieval era, but there's a reason why weddings took place in the summer. And they weren't always on Saturday, you know that, right?
Yeah.
it's just whenever it was convenient, you know.
Yeah.
They didn't have to go to banquet halls to do this. No, it's just, you know, the thing is, it's very, very basic routines that can really change the mineral status of the body.
Yeah, that's cool. If Dr. Liz is there, thank you, Dr. Liz, for the bath formula. We appreciate
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Before the next time we talk, we're gonna do a few foot baths. We can't do a full bath right now because our plumbing's just as messed up. So if we fill up the whole bath, so okay.
And the thing is, here's the difference between Dr. Liz and me. I'm the showman, and she's the shaman. She's the real doctor here. I'm just an entertainer.
Oh my God.
I'm the showman.
You're the face.
The show. I'm the face, exactly. And she's the pretty face, right, yeah.
Yeah, Dr. Liz knows best. Women are smarter than men.
That's right. No dispute. I'm very much at peace with that. No, my goal is I'm going to spend the rest of my life trying to learn what she's forgotten.
Aww. Oh, I love that. Yeah. Okay. Do you have any more?
Kind of a loaded question.
Should I sit down? Should I sit down for this?
Probably lay down. Relationship between magnesium deficiency with things like type 2 diabetes and autoimmunity. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Again, how much time do we have?
I know. See, that's why I was like, oh man.
Maybe that's the last question.
Well, what's important to understand is what is diabetes and what is autoimmune? You know, we have to create the right context. And one of the best articles on diabetes that I found, and again, I don't remember all the authors and years. A lot of them I can, but this one is a particularly important one that for some reason it's not registering. But the gist of the article was, if you want to create diabetes, add iron. If you want to stop diabetes, chelate iron out of the system. And it was that direct. And this is particularly in animal studies. They feed iron to animals, they get diabetes. They chelate it out and they stop getting diabetes. Now, what's important for folks to understand is that diabetes actually starts in the pancreas. And there are cells in the pancreas called acinar, A-C-I-N-A-R, acinar cells that are the actual cells that make the enzymes that we use in our digestive tract to break food down. What a lot of people don't know is where does the digestive process start when we're eating food? Do you guys know where it starts?
Is it even with the eyeballs and the senses?
With the senses, right. You know, it's in the mouth.
The tongue?
The amylase enzyme expresses in the mouth to break down the food, particularly the carbohydrates. And that's why chewing your food is so important. And chewing it a lot. More than most people are used to. But the pancreas is incredibly important for digesting food. And it's also very sensitive to iron. Incredibly sensitive to iron. So when you add iron filings to the grains, it starts to affect the digestive tract, including the pancreas. And so the process of diabetes starts in the pancreas, and when that gets messed up, then it starts to put stress on the liver. And the whole dynamic, so you have two broad categories of diabetes, type 1 and type 2. There's some that would argue that Alzheimer's is type 3. But type 1 is where you're not able to make insulin, and it's typically from birth. But there are more and more people who are getting it from medication, just wiping out their system. And the beta cells in the pancreas can't make the insulin. Why? Because they're rusty. They get burned up. Exactly. And so type 2 is, you know, during the course of your life, and it's insulin resistance. Why is there resistance to insulin? Well, there's a very important enzyme in the cells called tyrosine kinase enzymes. They're supposed to allow the insulin in. And what does that enzyme need? It's got to have magnesium.
Ah, no way.
So if you don't have magnesium, you're going to become more insulin resistant, and you're not going to be able to get the full benefit of the food that you're eating. And then it begs the question, where did the magnesium go? What's being burned up by the increase in the iron? And so if there isn't copper in the diet, iron will start to rise. And as the iron rises, especially in the liver, which is where the bulk of the insulin resistance is. Insulin resistance is principally the liver and the muscle cells, but the bulk of it's in the liver. And as the iron rises, it's pushing magnesium out. Why? Because there's a lot of oxidative stress with the iron, and we have this magnesium burn rate. And so then the magnesium leaves, and then the enzymes aren't working right. One of those 3,752 enzymes is tyrosine kinase. And so if tyrosine kinase can't fire up, insulin can't get in. Insulin stays in the bloodstream, and it's really powerful and toxic, and it starts to really agitate the body. And so it's the copper iron dynamic that's affecting the magnesium dynamic that's then affecting the ability to get insulin in the system. So that's diabetes in a nutshell. I know that's a very cryptic description. I mean, I could go on for about 3 hours and talk about it, but I don't think your followers have that kind of stamina, unless they had their feet in foot baths.
Okay. But we have to do another video on it then.
I think it's a fascinating area. And then you were asking about autoimmune.
I think that's a whole nother topic video too.
Well, it could be.
Yeah.
So just to give people kind of a blow by about what's going on.
Yeah.
There was no autoimmune 100 years ago. There was very little autoimmune 50 years ago. Now there are over 100 different autoimmune conditions. Well, that should make people think, wait, what's going on here? Has the environment changed? And what the system wants us to believe is that we're getting weaker. Come on. But that's what they want us to believe, that you're more sickly now. And they're silent about this iron thingy. They don't talk about iron. And so there are three very important researchers who are involved in this, or have been in the past. One is Nancy Andrews, who is a world-renowned hematologist at Duke University, and she's the former dean of the medical school there. She's an uber-credentialed hematologist, which means she loves to study blood. And Rebecca King, who's a world-renowned pathologist at Mayo Clinic, and a very gifted geneticist and biologist at Harvard Public School of Public Health, Marianne Wesling Resnick. These three women were bringing their research together to realize and triangulate that what was causing autoimmune was iron getting stuck in the recycling macrophages all over the body. And when these Pac-Men that are supposed to be working with iron get too full of iron, and the doorway won't let the iron out because it's a copper doorway, if the iron can't get out, the metabolic mechanisms begin to break down, and the macrophages lose their intelligence, and then they start to attack healthy tissue. And so what was designed by our maker and Mother Nature to be a source of health, the macrophage, becomes a source of attack, and that becomes a very serious problem.
And then I'm guessing similarly that increase in iron causes an increase in magnesium burn rate, and so low in magnesium as well.
And so, you know, rheumatoid arthritis, that's autoimmune in the joints. Well, there's very rich literature about how that is caused by too much iron. Multiple sclerosis, it's another autoimmune condition. We could do a whole conversation just on that alone.
Yeah.
But it's important for people to realize that there's a common point of origin through the metabolic breakdown that occurs from lack of copper, too much iron, increased oxidative stress, and now it just begins to foster a metabolic response that presents symptoms that have been classified as autoimmune, but there is no disease. These are metabolic mechanisms responding to funky oxygen molecules.
So I know that
when you go to the doctor and they tell you you have an autoimmune condition, you're told it's chronic. And so if you are somebody who starts taking the mineral balance very seriously, do you think that you could fully put your autoimmune condition back into remission, especially if you've got like your diet right and your lifestyle choices right?
Yeah, I think, again, we have to be careful about over-promising and under-delivering.
Yeah.
And so a lot of factors, you know, what's the age of the individual? What's their belief system? Do they really believe their body has the natural ability to heal itself? Do they have the discipline to change their diet? It's actually easier to get people to change their religion than to change their diet. Will they follow through with a protocol? Will they follow through with the emotional release work? Anyone who has an autoimmune condition thinks they're broken. And so if you think you're broken, well, then that begins to set in play a whole series of events. And are you able to let go of that belief? Are you willing to acknowledge that my body has an unlimited capacity to rebuild itself? So, you know, are they able to donate blood? Are they willing to donate blood? Are they in a position to donate blood? Do they have food sensitivities that need to be addressed as well? You know, what's their pathogenic load? And again, I'm not agnostic about pathogens, but what I caution people from doing is don't assume that attacking the bugs is building the immune system, because it's not. And so I'm much more focused on strengthening the host than attacking the guest. And so then a lot of people say, well, I'll do both. No, you can't do both. It doesn't work that way. You gotta pick your paradigm. Which field of play am I gonna work in? If I believe that I've got pathogens and I've got to get rid of them, well, it doesn't mean you can do both, because it's gonna confuse the body. And not everyone's willing to hear that or follow through on that. So, Sarah, it's a very fair question. Is it possible to reverse these? Absolutely possible. Does it work for everybody? No, because not everyone is in a state of mind or state of being to allow that to happen. Do they believe that their genes are broken? Do they believe that whole mythology? Because if they're stuck there, it's very hard for them to believe that their body can rebuild itself. And again, not everyone knows that genes are an expression of the energetic field of the individual. And if the energetic field isn't optimal, well, then gene expression can't be optimal. They're not broken. They're responding to their environment. And so it's important for people to have that sense of perspective and context that if they really want to solve this, they need to be able to account for all of that. And the people who do, I have this ability. I mean, there are too many success stories to say that it doesn't happen, but it doesn't happen 100% of the time. And there's always extenuating circumstances.
Yeah. And it may not happen like 100% of the way either. Like your blood work may still demonstrate elevated levels.
Exactly.
When I first got diagnosed with an autoimmune condition, I felt very victimized and I didn't think I could do anything because I was told it was chronic. And so this is before we got into all the different like health series we've gone through to try to heal from it.
The doctor basically told her lupus will come to you at some point.
Right. And so I was stuck in that mindset of like, oh, like what do I can't do anything. I'm just going to be sick. I was very scared. Right. And so it wasn't until I started to actually make those like drastic dietary changes and I actually saw results that I started to believe that I could reverse it. And I think that's very powerful. And then I saw her blood work where she fully reversed hers. And although my blood work never came back like fully reversed, I still feel better.
Yeah.
And that's powerful. And so I fully understand what you're saying. You have to believe it first.
Yeah.
You do. And so, you know, I have a sister who's 4 years older.
Oh. You have a sister who's what?
4 years older, who's a nurse. And she believes all her training. And she's had lupus her entire adult life. And she's taken, the hormone? Prednisone for over 40 years. And it's not done her any favors. And so I'm very aware of what lupus is and what it can do. And again, it's just a label. It absolutely is just a label. And it's important for people to realize that it doesn't matter what the label is, there is a path back. And again, I'm not trying to be naive or Pollyannish about, oh, don't worry about the label, but don't be intimidated by it and don't be frozen by it. I mean, that's the first reaction is when you hear a label like that, you're like, oh my gosh, I'm broken. And that's, I think that a lot of conventional doctors, regardless of what degrees or faith they have, I think they do their patients a disservice by not giving them some sense of perspective about how did this happen. And again, they are products of their training. And I think what's important for people to realize is that the mistake that most doctors make is that they confuse their training with the truth. And they're not one and the same. Just because the doctor heard this in their classroom doesn't mean it's the absolute truth. And so that becomes a very important framework for people to work from, is to begin to realize that there's more to the story. And I think it's wonderful that you were able to witness with Ashley that there was a change and that you were able to then get some kind of context and some perspective that, well, I can change too. And then you begin to feel better. And again, I'm not sure what all the blood markers are involved in your situation, but over time, I would argue that they will eventually settle down and that they will self-correct, because the body is designed for homeostasis. The mechanisms of machinery that really wants us to stay in balance, it's unbelievable what the body will do to try to keep us in that state of homeostasis and keep us in balance.
Yeah. Well, very grateful that we're able to have these conversations with you, because my doctor didn't tell me this stuff, but also unfortunately my naturopathic doctor didn't really talk about as many of the things that we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very valuable that people hear this information. And I'm really looking forward to discussing our comparison between our mineral blood work and our hair and tissue mineral analysis. Who's stronger? And I'm excited. And so that'll be for our audience, that'll be next week's discussion, where we'll kind of talk about the different testing methods, and then we'll compare who's minerally stronger.
Gee, I wonder who wants to be one. Who wants to be number one?
Her personality, but I of course want to be.
Do you all have a little bit of, have you wagered a bet to see what the payoff is going to be?
We still got to do that. We have a week. We'll announce it at the start of the video.
Okay.
So then it has to solidify.
Yeah. I mean, I think you really want to make this worthwhile, right?
Okay. Actually, we'll take a poll on our Instagram what we should do.
And that's
we'll
a good idea.
I was going to say, who has to pick up the dog poo for a week?
No. Ooh, wow.
That's your job.
That's an intense bet, you know? Yeah.
We'll see.
No. Who does the dishes?
That's a combined effort, actually.
Yeah. We're eating so much food and so often right now for like fixing our hormones that it's just constant.
That's my part-time job.
So why do you think your hormones aren't working right?
I probably have too much iron, and my magnesium burn rate is probably out of the roof.
And she doesn't believe. She believes she's broken.
No, I don't. I've really been changing that mindset after our discussion. I really have.
That's good. And I think, again, when you get the bandwidth back after the middle of September, then you'll have a chance to really dig into the emotional release work.
Yeah, I'm excited about it.
A little hard right now. You know, you're just heads down. You want to get through the process.
Yeah.
I think that'll be a lot of fun next week.
And, yeah.
I mean, I know who the better sister is, but I'm not going to say.
I'm excited. Okay.
So what are the niggly questions that people still have about this material that we're covering?
Magnesium?
Yeah, or whatever.
Well, we've covered all the magnesium questions. I think We'll gather up the final magnesium and iron questions and do that at the end of next video or do another video. Okay. I think that we addressed a lot of them in our last video that people had. But we'll make sure we'll announce to everyone. If you guys, talking to the audience now, if you guys have any more questions about magnesium or iron, hit them in the comments below.
Well, I would like to do a follow-up on these minerals and their relationship to autoimmune, because that is a huge part of our channel. And so
that'd be fun.
You put a little sticky on that.
Do you have any idea what the breakdown is of what conditions people might have?
We'll pull. I can pull people. I think.
I would assume there's going to be a fair number with thyroid issues, Hashimoto's, things like that.
That's a huge one we see on our channel. Like people coming and talking about it.
Yeah. MS is going to be big. There may be a few people that do have lupus.
I think there's a lot of undiagnosis too, and people just have kind of done their own research and are like, or they have fatigue and they need to read your book, but. I think as a general, people just have like the fatigue, the bad digestion, and so they're kind of correlating it to an autoimmune condition.
Okay. Most of society has an autoimmune condition these days.
I'll plant a seed right now and just let you guys kind of digest what to do with this. So you know that we live in a solar system, right? We have a sun and we have a bunch of planets that circle the sun. And so let's use that as an analogy for all of the discussion we've had has been around how to manage oxygen and prevent it from acting out, right? That's kind of quietly and maybe not so quietly playing in the background. One of my students asked a very innocent question the other day about why do people use lasers and red light? And I very flippantly said, oh, it's because nitric oxide gets in the way of the mitochondria and it blocks energy production. And I should have just left it there. But I said, gee, I wonder what else I don't know about nitrogen. Okay? And you guys are sitting down, and I'm hoping that your audience is sitting down too. But what I'm coming to realize is that there is an entirely parallel universe of dysfunction that relates to nitrogen. And there's actually a third universe that relates to sulfur. Now, the term in the literature is called RONS, R-O-N-S, reactive oxygen, nitrogen, and sulfur species.
Wow.
Now, put on your thinking caps. Who do you think stirs up the pot of RONS?
Iron.
Ding, ding, ding. Exactly. And who puts out the fire?
Magnesium. Of RONS? Copper.
Copper.
Oh.
Yeah. And what's yeah, right. Yeah, she won. I feel like I'm at a wrestling match. The reason why I bring it up is I'm perpetually amazed at how this process of discovery keeps growing, but it all comes back to the same focal point. So that we have this universe of oxygen, we have this universe of nitrogen, we have this universe of sulfur that are very reactive. I mean, they're like, oh my gosh, what, you know, if we don't keep those under wraps, we're going to have a lot of problems. But if copper and iron aren't happy, then the whole thing blows up. And so it's important for people to realize that there's a lot of static in our environment that can cause problems. But by getting control over these focused minerals that we keep talking about, they can really get mastery over their health, their energy levels, and their overall well-being. I just wanted to share that with the group because I think it'll take me probably the rest of the year to really understand this nitrogen thing. And then I'll start to focus on the sulfur. But what's important for people to realize is that reactive oxygen, reactive nitrogen, and reactive sulfur all kill energy production.
And so you're saying that red light therapy,
it bypasses the, I don't know about the night, I do know about the nitrogen, but what it does is it, the mitochondria think in terms of red light.
Okay.
And so it provides the red light that they need to complete their cycle.
Okay.
Which is a good thing, right? Yeah. The part that was a bit of a surprise for me is that there's a mechanism inside the mitochondria to make nitric oxide. So then it begs the question, why would Mother Nature create a mechanism that creates something that can block the energy production? And there's a reason, but it's all about understanding the communication between the elements and what the body's trying to do.
See, this is why I appreciate Morley so much, is you started with magnesium and then you realized like, whoa, it's like a lot more complicated than just magnesium. You took a step back and you understood like the iron and copper, and now you're taking another step back and being like, hold on, there's more to this puzzle. And so you're just like constantly learning and constantly discovering. You're not just making a single claim. It's cool. And I'm excited to
hear what you learn about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think what's important is that there may be adaptations to the protocol, but what has held true for a good 5 years now is the protocol hasn't changed. We can tweak it at the edges, and things like adding red light would be something that we've seriously considered adding.
Yeah,
there are other components, but for the most part, it hasn't really altered. And I think it's important for people to know that there's an essence to the design of the body that allows us to weather these different storms, regardless of what solar system it happens to be coming from, which is, I think that's just amazing.
Yeah.
It's incredibly empowering to think that if we can get the mechanism right, then we can deal with any challenge that we've got.
Yeah. Well, cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I hope everyone enjoyed the magnesium discussion. And again, if you guys have any more questions, hit them in the comments below. And Morley, do you remember how we end our videos?
Something about being an angel.
There you go. Okay, ready?
Wonderful.
Three, two, one. Behave like
an angel.
There you go.